Peter had to presume that Calef was watching him. After his murder of Baroness Altman, Calef's interest would be intense. Peter had to act predictably. He caught the early Monday flight back to Brussels, and before midday was at his desk in Namco headquarters. Here also he was the centre of much interest and power play. Altman Industries had lost its chief executive, and there were strong undercurrents and court intrigues already afoot. Despite a number of subtle approaches, Peter stayed aloof from the struggle. On Tuesday evening, Peter picked up the newspaper from the newsstand in the Hilton lobby. Stephen's contact request was in the small ads section. "The children of Israel asked counsel of the Lord, saying, 'Shall I go up again to battle?' Judges 20:23." The quotation that Calef had chosen seemed to epitomize his view of himself. He saw himself as godlike, set high above his fellow men. Stephen had explained to Peter that Calef took up to 48 hours to answer. Stephen would wait each day after the appearance of the personal announcement at his desk in his office suite in Leadenhall Street, from noon until 20 minutes past the hour. He would have no visitors nor appointments for that time, and he would make certain that his direct, unlisted telephone line was unengaged to receive the incoming contact. There was no contact that Wednesday, but Stephen hadn't expected one. On the Thursday, Stephen paced restlessly up and down the antique silk Kerman carpet as he waited for the call. He was already wearing the jacket of his suit, and his bowler and rolled umbrella were on the corner of the ornate French ormolu desk that squatted like some benign monster beneath the windows which looked across the street at Lloyd's Exchange. Stephen Stride was afraid. He acknowledged the fact with direct self-honesty. Intrigue was part of his existence, had been for nearly all of his life, but always the game had been played to certain rules. He knew he was entering a new jungle, a savage wilderness where those few rules ceased entirely to exist. He was going in over his head. Peter had pointed out to him that this was not his way, and he knew Peter was right. Peter was right, and Stephen was afraid as he had never been in his life. Yet he knew that he was going ahead with it. He had heard that it was the mark of true courage, to be able to meet and acknowledge fear, and yet control it sufficiently to be able to go ahead and do what duty dictated must be done. He did not feel like a brave man. The telephone rang once, too loud, too shrill, and every nerve in his body jumped taut, and he found himself frozen, paralyzed with fear, in the center of the beautiful and precious carpet. The telephone rang again. The insistent double note sounded in his ears like the peal of doom, and he felt his bowels filled with a hot, oily slime of fear, hardly to be contained. The telephone rang the third time, and with an enormous effort he forced himself to make the three paces to his desk. He lifted the telephone receiver and heard the sharp chimes of the interference from the public telephone system. "Stride," he said. His voice was strained, high and almost shrill, and he heard the drop of the coin. The voice terrified him. It was an electronic drone, inhuman, without gender, without the timbre of living emotion, without neither high nor low notes.
"Aldgate and Leadenhall Street," said the voice.
Stephen repeated the rendezvous, and immediately the connection was broken. Stephen dropped the receiver onto its cradle and snatched up his bowler and umbrella as he hurried to the door. His secretary looked up at him and smiled expectantly. She was a handsome, grey-haired woman who'd been with Stephen for 15 years.
"Sir?" She still called him that.
"I'm popping out for half an hour, May," Stephen told her. "Look after the shop, there's a dear."
And he stepped into his private elevator and rode down swiftly to the underground garage where his Rolls was kept, together with the private vehicles of his senior executives. In the elevator mirror, he checked the exact angle of his bowler, a slightly raffish tilt over the right eye,
and rearranged the bloom of the crimson carnation in the buttonhole of the dark blue Savile Row suit with its faint and elegant chalk stripe. It was important that he looked and acted entirely naturally during the next few minutes. His staff would remark on any departure from the normal. In the garage, he did not approach the dark maroon Rolls-Royce, which glowed in the subdued lighting like some precious gem. Instead, he went towards the wicket gate in the steel roll-up garage door, and the doorman in his little glass cubicle beside the door looked up from his football pool's coupons, recognised the master, and leapt to his feet.
"Afternoon, Gov." "Good day, Harold. I won't be taking the car, just stepping out for a few minutes."
He stepped over the threshold of the gate, into the street, and turned left, down towards the junction of Leadenhall Street and Aldgate. He walked fast, without seeming to hurry. Caliph spaced his intervals very tight, to make it difficult for the subject to pass a message to a surveillance unit. Stephen knew he had only minutes to get from his office to the call box on the corner. Caliph seemed to know exactly how long it would take him. The telephone in the red-framed and glass call box started to ring when he was still 20 paces away. Stephen ran the distance.
"Stride,"
he said, his voice slightly puffed with exertion, and immediately the coin dropped, and the same electronic droning voice gave him the next contact point. It was the public call box at the High Street entrance to Aldgate Tube Station. Stephen confirmed, and the voice troubled him deeply. It sounded like that of a robot from some science fiction movie. It would not have been so bad if he had felt human contact. The two receiving stations, neither of which was predictable, and the distances between them had been carefully calculated to make it only just possible to reach them in time, to make it impossible for the call to be traced while the line was still open. Caliph or his agent was clearly moving from one call box to the next in another part of the city. Tracing them even a minute after he had left would be of no possible use in trying to establish identity. The voice distorter that Caliph was using was a simple device, no bigger than a small pocket calculator. Peter had told Stephen that it could be purchased from a number of firms specializing in electronic surveillance, security, and countermeasure equipment. It cost less than $50, and so altered the human voice, phasing out all sound outside the middle range, that even the most sophisticated recording device would not be able to lift a usable voice print to compare with a computer bank memory. It would not even be able to determine whether the speaker was a man, a woman, or a child. Stephen had an unusually clear path to the station, and found himself waiting outside the call box in the crowded entrance to the station, while a young man in paint-speckled overalls, with long, greasy blonde hair, finished his conversation. Caliph's system allowed for prior use of the chosen public telephone, and as soon as the scruffy youth finished his leisurely chat, Stephen pushed into the booth and made a show of consulting the directory. The phone rang, and even though he was expecting it, Stephen jumped with shock. He was perspiring now, with the walk and the tension, and his voice was ragged as he snatched the receiver.
"Stride," he gulped.
The coin dropped, and Caliph's impersonal tones chilled him again.
"Yes?"
"I have a message."
"Yes?"
"There is danger for Caliph."
"Yes?"
"A government intelligence agency has put an agent close to him, close enough to be extremely dangerous."
"Say the source of your information."
"My brother, General Peter Stride."
Peter had instructed him to tell the truth as much as was possible.
"Say the government agency involved."
"Negative. The information is too sensitive. I must have assurance that Caliph receives it personally."
"Say the name or position of the enemy agent."
"Negative, for the same reasons."
Stephen glanced at his gold Cartier tank watch with its black alligator strap. They had been speaking for 15 seconds. He knew the contact would not last longer than 30 seconds. Caliph would not risk exposure beyond that time. He did not wait for the next question or instruction.
I will pass the information only to Caliph. I must be certain it is him, not one of his agents. I request a personal meeting.
That is not possible,
droned the inhuman voice. Then Caliph will be in great personal danger, Stephen found courage to say it.
I repeat, say the name and position of enemy agent.
25 seconds had passed. I say again, negative. You must arrange a face-to-face meeting for transfer of this information. A single droplet of sweat broke from the hairline of Stephen's temple and ran down his cheek. He felt as though he was suffocating in the claustrophobic little telephone box.
You will be contacted,
droned the voice, and the line clicked dead. Stephen took the white silk handkerchief from his top pocket and dabbed at his face. Then he carefully rearranged the scrap of silk in his pocket, not folded into neat spikes, but with a deliberately casual drape. He squared his shoulders, lifted his chin, and left the booth. Now, for the first time, he felt like a brave man. It was a feeling he relished, and he stepped out boldly, swinging the rolled umbrella with a small flourish at each pace. Peter had been within call of the telephone all that week, during the hours of involvement with a series of Namco projects which he had put in train before his departure for Tahiti, and which all seemed to be maturing simultaneously. There were meetings that began in the morning and lasted until after dark. There were two separate day journeys, one to Oslo and another to Frankfurt, catching the early businessman's plane and back in the Namco office before evening. Always, he was within reach of a telephone, and Stephen Stride knew the number. Even when he was in the NATO Officers Club gymnasium, sharpening his body to peak physical condition, or practicing until after midnight in the underground pistol range, until the 9mm Cobra was an extension of his hands, either hand, left or right, equally capable of grouping the X circle at 50 meters, from any position, standing, kneeling or prone. Always, he was within reach of the telephone. Peter felt like a prize fighter in training camp, concentrating all his attention on the preparations for the confrontation he knew lay ahead. At last, the weekend loomed, with the prospect of being boring and frustrating. He refused invitations to visit the country home of one of his Namco colleagues, another to fly down to Paris for the Saturday racing, and he stayed alone in the Hilton suite, waiting for the call from Stephen. On Sunday morning he had all the papers sent up to his room, English and American and French, German, which he could read better than he spoke, and even the Dutch and Italian papers, which he could stumble through haltingly, missing every third word or so. He went through them carefully, trying to find a hint of Caliph's activity, new abductions, hijackings, or other acts which might give him a lead to some new Caliph-dominated pressures. Italy was in a political uproar, the confusion so great that he could only guess at how much of it was from the left and how much from the right. There had been an assassination in Naples of 5 known members of the terrorist Red Brigade, all 5 taken out neatly with a single grenade.